Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, part two in our series commemorating the centenary of World War I. In 1916, an Anzac soldier returned from the front, so badly psychologically damaged that for 12 years he could not tell a soul who he was. His case was extreme, and we'll tell you his incredible story on the program today. The trauma of the Great War affected everyone and washed through Australian society in ways nobody was prepared for. Today's program is a history of war trauma, from shell shock to what we know today as post-traumatic stress disorder. How much have we learned, and then forgotten, about war and trauma in the past century?
This story is to be neither an accusation nor a confession, and least of all an adventure. For death is not an adventure to those who stand face to face with it. It will try simply to tell of a generation of men who, even though they may have escaped its shells, were destroyed by the war.
First World War, it was shell shock. Second World War, battle fatigue.
And before that was cowardice.
Yeah, that's right.
And sometimes people call it the history of forgetting, because what tends to have happened is that each time we've had a major war, we have certain things that we learn as a result of that, and then it's like that's just forgotten. By the time the next war comes around, we're starting from scratch.
Now, if you could see the list of people who've committed suicide, you would cry your eyes out. Yep. There are so many. I sit there and you look, you just go down the list. There's just pages after pages.
Does war cause them to have a blighted life? Does war mean that they don't find steady employment, that their marriages break down, that they turn to alcohol? Were they going to do that anyway? Or is war the culprit? And how do you answer that question?
The guns are quiet now, the papers of peace have been signed, and the oceans of the earth are filled with ships coming home. In faraway places, men dreamed of this moment, but for some men, the moment is very different from the dream. Here is human salvage. The final result of all that metal and fire can do to violate mortal flesh.
That's the opening of acclaimed film director John Huston's 1946 documentary, Let There Be Light. It offers an extraordinary insight into the treatment of war-damaged soldiers. But the film was banned by the US military because of the potentially demoralising effects it might have on recruitment. It was finally made public in 1981, 35 years later. The story of the film says a lot about the uneasy relationship between the military and psychiatry and soldiers themselves. World War I was the first time we experienced trauma on such a massive scale. But the world was ill-equipped to know what to do once the guns fell silent. Historians are now looking through the repatriation records to see the extent of the damage. The medical records of returned servicemen offer a forgotten history, which runs parallel to the public story of the brave men of the Anzac legend. They were incredibly brave, but many were deeply troubled and in desperate need of help. Australia may well hold the record for rescuing the most shell-shocked Anzac soldier from the front in World War I. His amnesia was total. He couldn't even remember his own name.
A shell whizzes through the air. It lands and bursts with a mighty roar. A stupendous crashing, shattering sensation. The world must have broken in halves. Then comes a tumbling, some thuds, darkness, oblivion. 12 years ago, George Brown was buried alive under sandbags somewhere in France. Later, they dug him out of the sandbags anyway. But he has remained buried alive, lost to all the world, a man without home or friends or foes, a man who has lost his personality. He is Australia's unknown soldier, buried not in a cenotaph, but alive.
My name is Dr. Jen Roberts from the University of Wollongong, and I'm a war historian that specialises in World War I and particularly areas of trauma and psychological damage. In 1916, behind the lines in France along the Western Front, a young Australian soldier was discovered. He was panicked, he was dishevelled, he was completely disorientated. He had no memory and no way of identifying himself, save for the fact that he was wearing an Australian Army hat. He had no other insignia or identification on him. And when he was interviewed by the soldiers that found him, he was just so incoherent as to be unintelligible. He was taken to an advanced dressing station where doctors immediately recognised the symptoms of severe shell shock. He was then taken to another casualty clearing station and eventually to a hospital in London.
September 1916. Dull, depressed, has not improved, moody and apathetic, shows loss of memory, completely disoriented, expression vacuous, semi-stuporous, recommended for discharge as permanently unfit.
In late 1916, though, he was still not able to identify himself and there could be no record found that matched his description, but yet clearly he was a damaged Australian soldier and he was sent back on a ship called the Corulla with other war-damaged soldiers back to Australia at the end of 1916.
He is morbidly dull and confused, has next to no idea where he is, when or why he came here, and is indifferent. He cannot care for himself.
The doctors, at a loss, just wrote a random name down on a file. They wrote down George Brown, and that's what they called him. But the staff started to refer to him as the unknown patient. George's treatment went on and on and on, well into the 1920s, where his condition really, really deteriorated. When he was able to express himself, he would repeat the same phrases over and over again. He would often just sit there rocking backwards and forwards in the chair, rolling up his coat as if it was a child and rocking it.
He states that people's voices, who are unseen, worry him by calling him a coward. His memory is so dull that he cannot answer any question except by answering, "I don't know, I don't know."
By the mid-1920s, he was severely psychologically disturbed and was actually starting to be incredibly violent, both towards himself in terms of self-harm, but also violent towards the doctors and the nursing staffs at Callan Park. So he was actually basically rendered into an isolation wing where mostly his behaviour was controlled with sedation and physical restraint.
1921. Still the same. Mischievous, idle, careless. 1923. Behaviour increasingly erratic. He has a habit of inserting matches in his ears. 1924. Stuffs his nose with rags. Very destructive.
So in 1928, we're not sure who, but I'm guessing it was a new doctor or a new nurse, suddenly took pity on this poor wreck of a man who had been there for 12 years, contacted the newspapers, and they sent a photograph of George Brown saying, "Can anyone help identify..."
The unknown patient of Callan Park. Do you know him? Unknown soldier's living death. It is under the name of George Brown that this worried-looking unknown soldier spends aimless days and years at Callan Park. Back from the European war came the unknown warrior, mentally buried alive in faraway Flanders, but physically here in Sydney. He passed through these gates to Callan Park. Will he ever come out? The truth, Sydney, the 25th of March, 1928.
Two things happened. Firstly, hundreds and hundreds of bereaved families saw that story and contacted Callan Park, wanting to know if it was their son. And if it wasn't, the fact that there was one that was lost and now found, could that mean that perhaps their son, who they had presumed dead for now more than 10 years, be somewhere hidden away and unable to know who he was. So hundreds of people actually came to Callan Park to look at George, to make sure in their own mind that it wasn't their son or their husband. Hundreds more wrote letters.
Do anything to find out where my son is, if he is living or not. If you have a son at the front, you will have an idea of what it is like to wait for months for news.
If our darling happens to be alive, he has dark brown curly hair and blue eyes. I feel at times my darling...
I only wish you could tell me if you knew he was buried.
To us.
My sorrow would not be so great.
He's in a hospital, or he might have lost his memory. We cannot tell.
Most of them write in similar vein. They cannot believe, they say, that their father or husband or brother is dead, though officially reported killed or missing, because they received none of his personal belongings, not even the identification disc.
The second thing that happened was a complete coincidence. A young man who was travelling through New South Wales happened to see the newspaper. He happened to see the story, and he recognised the photo as that of a man that he had been to school with in New Zealand. So he was a New Zealand soldier who had enlisted in 1915. He'd seen action at Gallipoli and then gone on to the Western Front. The old school friend has said, I know this man. He identified a tattoo that he had on his arm and he identified the man's real name and gave a contact to his family in New Zealand. Immediately the RSL stepped in and they sent, along with the doctors from Callan Park, a photograph over to the equivalent of the RSL in New Zealand. And representatives of that organisation went to the house and they knocked on the door.
She clasped the photograph to her, murmuring, yes.
Yes, that is my George. God bless him. God bless him.
Before fainting into the arms of her daughter. That night, in a shaky hand, she wrote possibly the happiest letter of her life.
We've been looking for you to come home for a long time. Thank God you were found. Hope to see you soon. Fondest love from your loving mother.
The New Zealand government actually paid for her passage across on a ship to Sydney. The doctors met her and said, look, you need to be prepared for the fact that he won't know you. You need to be prepared for the fact that he doesn't look anything like the boy that you remember. Well, she was having none of that. She bowled up to the gates at Callan Park at about 7:30 in the morning and demanded to be let in to see her son. Meanwhile, this is all under the gaze of the tabloid press that had been instrumental in publicising the case, were there in their dozens with cameras and journalists waiting for this wonderful moment and to record it. So everyone was under enormous pressure. They took her inside to the room where they had put George, and she walked in and he looked up and he looked at her and he looked...
How can that dramatic, pathetic moment be described? A tense second of mutual bewilderment. Then the mother embraced her son, calling him darling, darling, and with tears flooding her eyes, kissed him and kissed him again. The tender demonstration puzzled him. You have been crying, Mum, he said.
I can never thank the New Zealand government and the Australian government enough for having given me the opportunity of going to Australia, staying for some weeks with my son and returning with him to New Zealand. My son shows much improvement since I landed in Sydney, and I'm going back to New Zealand with a very much lighter heart than when I arrived. I also feel that it's probably only a question of time when my son will have his mind fully restored.
As they came into the harbour at Wellington, his sister and his brother were on the docks with their families waiting to greet him, and he recognised them immediately from the top rail of the boat as well. Now, they couldn't take him straight home. He really was that desperately unwell. So he needed to go to another institution in Wellington, which was the Porirua Hospital, which had been purposely fitted out, again, to treat shell-shocked New Zealand soldiers. But as he got older and probably being reunited with his family, the worst excesses of his erratic behaviour did become tempered. And he was able to spend more and more time out of the hospital at his mother's house. Now, he started to experience some heart failure in 1951, and just before the end of that year, he did pass away. He was buried with full military honours, and the pallbearers were returned soldiers from both the First and the Second World Wars. So his story comes full circle that he is eventually being able to be buried with his name and his rank fully restored to him.
Of the 60,000 Australians killed in World War I, 25,000 were listed as missing. So thousands of families had to endure what Dr. Jen Roberts calls the permanence of uncertainty. When the war ended, the soldiers didn't return, but the trauma came home to stay. Professor Martin Crotty teaches history at the University of Queensland.
It was extremely traumatic for the people who fought in it, and extremely traumatic for the people who were at home as well. And I think that while we might talk about things such as mateship and egalitarianism and the birth of the nation, at the base, at the very fundamental level, we need to remember that there were 60,000 Australians who were killed in World War I. And although that number is familiar to most people, we also need to remember, I think, that the trauma was spread much more widely. There were the wounded, there were the psychologically damaged, and on the home front there were the bereaved, those who suffered great anxiety with relatives being away. And this trauma washed through Australian society too. Whole sections of the Australian population became marginalised in the social conflicts that were brought about by the war. And what had been, in my view, a relatively cohesive and peaceful Australian society pre-war suffered trials and shocks that it hadn't been subjected to beforehand and that it hasn't experienced since. So in World War I, we had things such as violence in the streets, we had the persecution of minorities, we had mass strikes and so on. And the only, the closest we've got to this since would probably be the civil divisions of the 1960s. But the trauma in World War I and its effects on everyone, whether they went to the war or whether they stayed at home, was, I think, much greater. There are accounts of dysfunctional returned soldiers coming back to Australia almost as soon as the first hospital ships returned from Egypt in 1915. So people knew about them, people saw them, and people were gradually coming to terms with the fact that there were severe damages for those who had gone to the war. For example, recruiting committees sometimes asked their superiors not to send any more returned soldiers to act as recruiters because their behaviour in front of crowds was often erratic. So you could have Anzac Day speakers, for example, who were unable to finish their talks or unable to even start their talks because they became catatonic when they were asked to describe their experiences. The practice of firing volleys at Anzac Day events had to be discontinued because many of the returned soldiers went into shock at the sound of gunfire.
Just tell them how much they're needed out there. Tell them why you went, what it meant to you.
I can't say anything.
Remember some deed of heroism, some touch of nobility. Tell about it.
I can't tell you anything you don't know. We live in the trenches out there. We fight. We try not to be killed. Sometimes we are. That's all.
So we didn't get back at the end of the war this great mass of bronzed Anzac heroes. We got back a mass of more or less psychologically damaged and often physically damaged men returning from really the most awful experiences that one could contemplate.
You still think it's beautiful and sweet to die for your country, don't you? We used to think you knew. The first bombardment taught us better. It's dirty and painful to die for your country. When it comes to dying for your country, it's better not to die at all. There are millions out there dying for their country. What good is it?
Oh. Australia had a fairly generous system of pensions, war pensions, for returned soldiers who, for example, had lost a limb. There was a reasonably comprehensive system of retraining that was available to people who could no longer pursue their old trades. But in terms of mental damage, the understanding of the malaise of nerves, as it was often known, or neurasthenia or a fatigue, was the understanding of it wasn't good enough for the Australian repatriation system and the medical services to cope with.
There's a rule that says I have to ground anyone who's crazy.
I'm crazy.
Who says so?
Ask anybody. Ask Daily Talk with what? Hey, or tell him.
Tell him what?
Am I crazy?
He's crazy, all right.
Psychiatrists themselves, the medical community themselves, I think there's a degree of scepticism. To what extent it's the war and the trauma of war that is causing symptoms in all of the men. I'm Elizabeth Roberts-Pedersen and I lecture in history at the University of Western Sydney. I'm researching the way psychiatrists conceptualised and treated war neurosis in the Second World War.
OK, let me see if I got this straight. In order to be grounded, I've got to be crazy. And I must be crazy to keep flying. But if I ask to be grounded, that means I'm not crazy anymore and I have to keep flying.
You've got it. That's catch 22.
In the medical literature, and it's not just in Australia, but in Britain and America as well, there's a sense that, look, not all of these men are necessarily breaking down because of combat stress. And even if they are breaking down because of combat stress, it may be because there is an underlying weakness in their personality. Now, it's not a very compassionate view, and it's not a view that we would espouse today when talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's a kind of psychodynamic explanation of war neurosis that doesn't look, that it doesn't regard trauma as an, or a traumatic event as an external stress. It says that interacts with the structure of an individual's personality.
They've had us locked away for such a long, long time. Nobody's as sad as we. Good news now and then, it makes our hopes so high. We think we'll soon be on a spree. But until they open up the gate, all that we can do is wait.
I'm Christina Toomey. I'm a professor of history at Monash University. I've been researching the place of prisoners of war of Japan in post-war Australia. And when I say their place in post-war Australia, I've been researching both their experiences in their dealings with the government and also the way the broader culture responded to them in the post-war period.
We've had malaria and beriberi. But now we've caught.
A lot of my research on this has been in the papers of a fund called the POW Trust Fund that ran from 1952 until 1977. So it's exactly this period where the understandings of war neurosis as being a condition that happens to those predisposed to it occurs. So there's some really interesting comments on the applications to this fund about anxiety states and war neurosis. And the trustees, several of whom are senior public service, some of whom are prominent ex-POW doctors or certainly men from the officer class, comment on all these applications that go past their desk. And their comments are so telling in terms of the understandings that were prevalent about war anxiety and neurosis. So sometimes, for example, you'll get trustees commenting on the form saying things like, oh, anxiety is a very elastic term. Or you'll get other comments on the application like, he says he has problems with alcohol and substance abuse, but I know that if we gave him a grant, he would take the money and he would go to the pub and he would drink the lot. There's very little understanding that this may be a result of their captivity. There's much more a tendency to think it's because these people are dissolute anyway.
Between the wars, military psychiatry was a neglected field of study.
and much of its understanding of war trauma was connected to battlefield experience, not the unique horrors of wartime captivity. Encouraged to move on with their peacetime lives, many survivors did not talk about their experiences at all. But in 1981, Tim Bowden recorded a series of groundbreaking interviews with men and women who for the first time spoke about what they had endured. Under the Geneva Convention, prisoners of war had a duty to try to escape. In Changi, the Japanese forced the Allied prisoners to break that promise.
15,400 in all were ordered to assemble, that was British and Australian troops, including those from the hospital, in the Selarang Barrack Square, which was the original parade ground for the Gordon Highlanders. And that square measured 150 yards by 250 yards and had one tap.
Men upon men upon men. Practically every square inch of the ground was covered with fellows with makeshift tents. And those who happened to be undercover were lucky.
People were just laying underneath whatever cover they could get, people with their limbs off and just recovering from the effects of the war in the way of amputations or limbs that had been blown off, or people half blind, or people with chest wounds just recuperating, not properly healed.
There were no latrines, so we had to dig through the Asheville Square.
Nothing in the way of sufficient food was given to us by the Japs. The cookhouses were situated among the latrine trenches on the square. So everything was absolutely chaos, and the discipline and morale of the blokes was something that you'd have to see to believe.
Black Jack Galligan came to me and said, "We'll put on a concert tonight." I said, "Where?" He said, "In the middle of the square." So we built a platform out of bits of wood and things, and we put on this concert to the largest audience we'd ever played to. 15,400, they couldn't get away. And the Japanese, by this time, had machine guns and mortars surrounding the square in case there was any attempt to break out. However, at the end of the concert, Black Jack walked up to me, I was then stage manager, and said, "Play the King." So the orchestra struck up the King, and over 15,000 sang "God Save the King," which I think was one of the most moving moments I can remember in Changi. Stunned the Japanese.
There was quite a well-known private narrative in families in the community about the psychological trouble that POWs were having, but it struggled to break through to the surface of the public way in which that experience was understood. Because one of the ways of overcoming the pain and the confronting nature of that experience was to write these memoirs that talked about it as being, you know, the Aussies pulling one over the Japanese, and how we were all mates, and Aussies survived in greater numbers than other nationalities in the camps, and we managed to make a joke in these very dark, bleak situations. When that's the dominant public narrative about what captivity had meant, it was very hard for this other story about the immense personal cost of it to come through.
In the meantime, the Japanese came and took Colonel Holmes and Colonel Callaghan out into a rubber strait. Two fellows had previously attempted to escape and took them into a rubber plantation where a Sikh firing squad lined up and shot them in the stomach. And the bloke said, "You rotten lot of bastards, you can't even bloody shoot straight." And the fellow said, "We have orders to shoot you there." Though we're still standing, and one bloke gathered himself up and saluted Holmes and Callaghan and saying, "It's all right, sir, we can cope." And then they were left to die. And Callaghan said, "I have submitted to be one of the most dreadful experiences that I've ever likely to have or ever likely want to have. I find it hard to talk about, but brave men have died today."
in the applications to this fund I mentioned before, they're given a, you know, two A4 sheets to describe their ongoing experience of hardship from captivity, for example. And many of them can't contain themselves to that form. So they then start writing letters to this anonymous bureaucrat who's administering the fund, describing how they've struggled to readjust and the kinds of issues that are confronting them around family breakdown, around alcohol abuse, around anxiety and inability to deal with employers. A lot of them talk about having an inferiority complex, really common term in these application forms, where they can't handle being told what to do by somebody in authority, or they don't like communicating in large groups with other people, and they have a desire to be on their own, and that they understand that this causes problems for their families and their wives and their children, but they can't bring themselves to break free of this feeling of being inferior to other people with whom they're interacting.
In 1943, the Japanese took thousands of prisoners on work parties up into the hills of Thailand. They were put to work on the infamous Thai-Burma Railway. Conditions were horrendous. The work was dangerous, their treatment was brutal, and they were all but starved to death. Thousands died.
As the remnants of us got off the trucks, some of the officers from the Changi side of it, they came over and they couldn't make out the condition we were in. And when the boys were helping us down the turnout, how are you, mate? And they just couldn't believe it. You know, 6.5, 7 stone. Some of them under 7 stone. It was unbelievable to see the bloody wrecks, and we were supposed to be the bloody hit men. That was the first time that they really knew what was going on. See, Singapore, anyone working on Singapore or any parties like that, that was the first news that they had of what brutality and disease-ridden bloody places and hardship really was when we came back. And no one knew anything about it.
So there's evidence in the contemporary documents of the Repatriation Commission and the Trust Fund that people are definitely experiencing these symptoms. And some of the forms, you can see that they've filled them out with their wives present, and then they've gone back after the wife's gone to bed and filled it in a different pen or a different colour, or they've written a cover letter saying, I don't want my wife to know this, or I don't want my wife to know I'm telling you this, but I have also been experiencing marital problems and I have trouble with impotence and I've lost the desire for sexual relations and this really troubles me. And I think that's an astonishing thing to say for a man in 1955. And the other really interesting thing about it is they don't talk about it so much in terms of their own demeaned masculinity, although that's certainly present. They talk about it in terms of being unable to satisfy their wives and how upset that makes them.
It was an incredible scene. It was a beautiful night, a moonlight night in Changi, with the tropical waters around the island. It was so beautiful. I can still hear the squeal of the brakes as the trucks lined up. And the people from Changi had come over to see us. They knew we were coming, look for new friends, old friends, and see how we were. And we got out of the trucks, a couple were dead, and we laid them on the ground. And we lined up on the road. Now, we were not ashamed because we were soldiers. And we wanted to look like soldiers. The people from Changi stood back aghast. We were like living cadavers. They stood back and uttered not a word. It was really quite strange. We lined up on the road as best we could and stood up as straight as we could. And those who couldn't stand up straight were on sticks, and those who couldn't really stop shaking with malaria were helped by their friends. And we thought this was what we should do as soldiers, to say that we were not beaten. And the sergeant major dressed us off, and we were in a straight line. And he went over and reported to her. And he said, "Oh, you're 2nd, 30th. All present and correct, sir." And Gallican said, "Where are the rest, Major?" He said, "They're all here, sir." And we were. And Blackjack Gallican, the Iron Man, broke down and cried. It was an incredible scene. We thought that we wanted to show them that we were soldiers.
Some of the files that I've seen where the man's a patient at a repatriation hospital, he's been admitted for having a nervous breakdown, unable to continue employment, problems with alcohol, the full picture. Sometimes psychiatrists write on the report and say, "I suspect this man is angling for a full pension." So there's definitely an assumption there that one should be very wary of symptoms that appear psychological in nature, because there may be a desire to get a totally permanently incapacitated pension and therefore be on the lookout.
The guns are silent now and the war is done. Come then, our rescuers, come with your flags and ribbons, the pretty playthings nations give to the side that won. The war is over now. I should rejoice, for I am young, was young, until these years advanced with all their fanfares to the victory, forgetting me. Now I must march again, join the new battle and brave the guns of peace. Ah, soldier, there is no surrender there, no hasty truce at hand to still that strife, no stretcher-bearers gathering our dead hopes, no prayers to offer for our little deaths in life. The earth is quiet now, and the sun and sky beckon unchanging to the sunless. Must we emerge? Aye, soldier, aye. There at the gate stands freedom. Here stand I.
I have a 7.62 bullet, and it was with me dog tags when I first went to Vietnam. And on that bullet is my regimental number and my name. And while ever I had that bullet on my person, I believed I couldn't be killed, because I had the bullet with my number on it.
The Vietnam War was the catalyst for the biggest turning point in the history of war trauma. And this change was brought about mainly by the activism and advocacy of veterans groups in the US and here in Australia. After the war ended in 1975, psychiatrists began to notice that countless men were reporting with symptoms that they initially termed post-Vietnam syndrome. During the 1970s, this syndrome eventually turned into the concept of post-traumatic stress. In 1980, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, was finally included in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. For the first time, it was understood that trauma was created by a catastrophic event outside the range of usual human experience. For the first time, soldiers were not to blame for their own distress.
Len Schultz, I served in Vietnam in 1970-71, and I was a regular soldier.
My name's David McCann. I served in the Royal Australian Navy. I joined the Navy so I would not have to go to Vietnam. I did my first initial 3 months basic training, and then they put us on a ship, and guess where we went?
Vietnam.
My name's Andy Forsdyke. I was artillery in Vietnam. I was dead unlucky. I was supposed to go to Malaya. I was in the gun battery, 107 battery. I was 18 and 11 months and 2 weeks when they left. And they said, no, you can't go to Malaya. You and this other young fella, Sawtell. They said, you've got to wait till you're 19 before you go to Malaya, because in the army you're not allowed overseas until you turn 19. So anyway, the day we both turned 19, they call us in and they said, right, you two are going to Vietnam. We said, where? I'd never heard of it. We said, no, we're going to Malaya. No, you're not. You're going to Vietnam. So we end up going to Vietnam. 4 days later, he was killed. The North Vietnamese were very good.
Yeah,
they were good soldiers. They crawled up to 4 feet in front of us and we didn't even know they were there. And they stood up with your hearts in your mouth then. Yeah. And actually, the bloke that got shot, he said to me, Andy, he said, you're shaking. And I said, mate, I've never been so scared in all my life. It was my knees were going 200 of the dozen. My hands were all right. It was my knees. I couldn't stop them.
You know, I was reading the other day that more people die on the roads at home than get killed in Vietnam.
Well, that's most reassuring, Harry.
Scott died in the chopper on the way to Vung Tau. Loss of blood.
Jesus.
I think the biggest problem is the majority of veterans won't talk about it to the average person, like, say, yourself, because you weren't there, so they will not talk to you. They'll talk to another veteran. And that's what you've got to do. You've got to tell other people. And that's why I do these interviews. I've done heaps of them. And it gets it out of your system. That's what the psych tells everyone. Get it out of your system. And I hit the brick wall in 93. We call it hitting the brick wall. And that's when things go bad. And work just went down the tube. And I retired at 43. And it just hit me, you know, after what had happened over there and the nightmares and all the things. Oh, I was good up until then. Great. And then just bang, it hit me. And that's what happens. You know something's wrong, but you don't know what it is. And then you just go off somewhere and, I walked all the way from Rose Hill to St Mary's the day I hit a bloke and walked home. And I don't even remember doing it.
So it was 81, February 81. I had a good job as a state manager for a transport company. Had everything. Young lass walked past the desk, said something. I don't know what she said, probably, oh, good morning, Mr. Shooks. I got up from behind me oak desk, followed her down to the photocopier and hit her twice. Walked back, sat down on me desk, wrote me resignation, and I've never worked since.
My name is Charles Gallagher. I served in Afghanistan in 1991-92 with the United Nations Mine Clearance Training Team to help the Afghan refugees living in Pakistan to clear their land back. They're full of landmines there. But however, you got different factions still fighting over there. What's happened is once an area is clear, the next day someone will go and mine it again.
Well, when Charles first came to me, right, and he walked into my front door, I gave my wife a nod, and she knew that this kid wasn't going to be alive in 12 months' time.
There's a lot of diggers out there. I'm talking about the younger veterans. First step is that they need to talk to someone. You know, just open up to someone, a friend or something.
The younger blokes are now coming through that first 10 years from their service. Oh, I'm all right, I'm 12 foot tall, bulletproof, you know, I'm the jungle train cooler. In their case, it's a desert train.
I was very lucky. I was in the darkness for probably 10 years, drank my life away. One day, I went and saw my doctor and didn't tell me that she went on holiday. So there's a new doctor there. Would you like to see this doctor? I was so hesitant to see him. Within a couple of minutes, he picked up the phone, rang Lynn straight away. You need to see this bloke ASAP. And I spent 2 weeks in detox. That was the best thing ever happened to me, detox. And I've been sober since September last year.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and I'm proud of what I've done. I'm just grateful that there are people out there help me out. It doesn't come on a plate. You got to do it yourself too. So that's why I'm here today, to get the message across to the younger veterans. Don't stay in the dark. Get out there and talk to someone, and you'll get that proper help.
In the 1970s, a lot of people thought ANZAC was all over. Attendances were down at the ANZAC Day ceremonies. In the wake of Vietnam, war was unpopular. But then, in the 1980s, there's this resurgence of interest in ANZAC. And a lot of cultural commentators and historians have scratched their heads and wondered, why is it? And there are a number of factors that explain that, and some of them are to do with domestic politics and so on. But one of them, I think, is this new interest in stories of trauma and victimhood. And the reason I say that is because the revival of interest in ANZAC coincides exactly with the discovery of post-traumatic stress disorder.
You'd better start to believe that the great majority of the wonderful people back home couldn't give two stuffs whether you lived or died. They're sitting on their asses in front of the television right now, and I bet my balls they're a damn sight more interested in Coronation Street than they are in your bloody welfare.
Bastards.
I first come back in 1967. Well, when I came back in 1967, had the ribbons on and everything else, went into the King's Cross RSL and they kicked us out.
Why?
Because we had the Vietnam ribbons on. From that day to probably about 5 years ago, wouldn't go near an RSL.
When you went on leave, you were told not to wear your uniform.
Yep.
Yep. We wore civvies.
Yep.
But times have changed. Like today, you go around to the schools and they love you.
That's different.
People can't do enough for you. Mm. Even when you go to doctors and lawyers, or anyway, it doesn't matter who you go to. And the moment they know you're a Vietnam veteran, they want to know what you did, and they're really interested. I think the old days, they're gone. You know, yeah. I forget about the bad times. I just think of the good times now.
Do young Willie McBride, do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside?
So war veterans who had been somewhat on the nose, I suppose you could say, in the 1960s and 70s as either out of touch with the contemporary society or as relics of a militaristic past or as somehow problematically involved in the Vietnam conflict, once you have a definition of trauma that posits war veterans as victims of this horrible event, war, it allows the public to re-embrace them at a moment when there's profound sympathy for people who've suffered this particular psychiatric condition on the behalf of the nation.
Or are you a stranger without even a name? Forever enshrined behind some old glass pane.
Is it something you've just lived with for the rest of your life? Or do you think it's curable?
I think you find ways to live with it. I have, you know. As I say, you talk about it. That's one way of getting it out of your system. But you always have flashbacks. You look at a name in the street, like, when I go up to Coffs Harbour, this is a place called Sawtell.
Yeah.
The moment I see that, I think of the bloke I was overseas with that was killed.
Yeah.
And there's things like that to trigger it and bring it back. You'll see a name or you'll see something.
An action
or something like that, and that brings it back. That's what does it. If you're at home, that's why a lot of guys won't leave home. They sit at home, half of them don't watch TV or read papers, and they do their own little thing in the men's shed or making pens like I do and things like that, you know, and you're not thinking about it. You listen to the music. I never listen to the news.
I'd say there wouldn't be too many Vietnam veterans who actually experience the front line or anywhere near the front line that doesn't have a slight touch of PTSD. That's a big statement, and I'm no medical person, but you talk to any one of your mates, doesn't matter what service they're in, they'll all admit that they feel a little different, and we're all different when we come back.
We've learnt nothing really, because after Vietnam we got out, what happened? The North came in and took over. all those years of fighting. The same thing's happening today.
Politicians budget for wars. They don't budget for the aftermath. So when it comes to the treatment 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, the budget just blows out because they haven't the billions of dollars that it's going to cost to keep the servicemen and women treated the way they should.
If you don't want to fix the soldiers up after it, don't send them.
Oh, Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drum slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? Did the band play the last post and
Eric Bogle's classic, The Green Fields of France, performed by the Dropkick Murphys. Today's feature was called The History of Forgetting, and it was produced by me, Lorena Allam, and Timothy Nicastri. We'd like to thank Len Schultz, David McCann, Andy Forsdyke, and Charles Gallagher for sharing their stories, and historians Jen Roberts, Tim Bowden, Elizabeth Roberts-Pedersen, Martin Crotty, and Christina Toomey. Special thanks to Jane Ullman. All the details are on our website, including links to sites where you can go to seek more information and help if you or any of your loved ones are suffering from PTSD.